Keeping the Faith with Steve Shoemaker is next.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Keeping the Faith. Steve is not with us this afternoon. He's your regular host. I'm substituting. My name is Don Nolan. I'm a professor of philosophy and religious studies at Parkman College. And this afternoon, we are very privileged and honored to have as our guests Dr. M. and Mrs. Ziba Siddiqui. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Siddiqui.
Siddiqui, yes. And
M.M. Muin.
Very good. Well, thank you very much. Dr. and Mrs. Siddiqui have been with us here in Champaign-Urbana. You've been spending the week of April 14th through the 21st as a scholar in residence at the Central Illinois Mosque and Islamic Center, I believe.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
So it's now over, and you'll be
almost,
leaving shortly.
Almost. This is the last item on our agenda.
Well, we're very grateful that you were able to join us and look forward to talking with you.
We appreciate it.
The topic of our program today is Building Muslim Communities in America, Issues and Challenges. And if you would like to call in, you're perfectly welcome to. This is a call-in show. If you'd like to call in from a local number, the number is 333-9455, same as WILL, 333-9455. You can also dial in on an 800 number, 800-222-9455. So if any time during the hour you'd like to call in to speak with Dr. Siddiqui or Ziba Siddiqui, feel free to call in. Well, the Siddiquis have been at the forefront of establishing a uniquely American Muslim institutions and Islamic educational materials, as I understand it, for both Muslims and non-Muslims in the United States primarily. Is that right?
Yes.
And Dr. Siddiqui, I believe you were born in Hyderabad, India. Did I say that correctly? And you were one of the early members of, is it the Muslim Student Association, MSA?
That's right. Yeah.
And you helped found the American Muslim Society of Social Scientists and Engineers. And you've served on several executive positions for the Islamic Society of North America. And Dr. Siddiqui is an emeritus professor of statistics at Colorado State University.
And Fort Collins.
In Fort Collins, Colorado. And I believe you've translated several important Arabic Islamic intellectual works into English.
That's good.
You've developed short courses and instruction for new Muslims, and you've authored many of the first U.S. published Islamic materials specifically designed for Muslims in the United States and North America. And if I could just finish our introductions here, we'll turn to you. Ziba Siddiqui is an American-born Muslim. You've written books on raising Muslim children in North America, Muslim children's books, and is the author under the pseudonym Suzanne Hanif. I'll have to ask you about that later.
That's right.
Of the popular Everything You Wanted to Know About Muslims and Islam,
I have to correct the title. It's What Everyone Should Know About Islam and Muslims.
What Everyone. What is the publisher? What is the publisher of that?
Ghazi Publications, Chicago.
And I understand that it is available at Borders. Is that right?
It's available through Amazon.
Ah, okay.
I don't know about Borders.
And there's also Path of God.
Islam, the Path of God. It's another book.
Right. Okay. And they've long been involved in interfaith activities, and looks like we're going to have a very enjoyable conversation. I look forward to it. Could you tell us a little bit about why you're here this past week as a scholar in residence? What have you been doing?
There is some program from Islamic Center here to invite scholars for a day or two to address students as well as community members on Islamic issues. But then they decided that maybe it would be more beneficial to the community if they bring someone to stay here for at least a week or 10 days, something mm-hmm. like that. This was a new experiment for them, it's a new experiment for me. So I came here on Saturday, and I have been here, and I've been giving talks, and also the sermon on the Friday sermon, I gave a Friday sermon. I've been meeting with small groups or large groups of people, discussing various issues of concern to the local Muslims here. They think that I am a scholar, but I'm a self-taught scholar, not in the sense of going to some Azhar University or something like that. Mm-hmm. But I have been, you know, I've been reading on my own and writing these books and so on and so forth. So I've been involved in the development of Muslims in this country since 1964. By the way, the Muslim Student Association of the United States and Canada was formed on this campus.
I was just going to say, yes, I understand this is the first one, isn't it?
1964. Right. That's for the whole country.
Right.
There were some 11 students from various universities got here, and they said, well, we have to have an association.
Have you been here before?
I have been here once before, but that was in the 70s early. I don't recall. There was mm-hmm. a very small community. There was no mosque. There was people used to meet in a trailer, you know.
Right.
So I remember very vaguely about that. But now it's quite a new experience. It has much expanded, much more people here. At least they tell me there are about 3,000 or plus Muslims in the Champaign-Urbana.
I have heard that figure.
Yeah.
And where did I hear 7 million across the United States? Is that about
7
right?
million, probably. Nobody knows exactly.
Right.
The Census Bureau does not include the question on religion because they think it is against the Constitution or something mm-hmm. which I don't agree with. So we don't have any idea how many there are. That's a conservative estimate, I'll say.
I see.
Yeah.
And you are from Hyderabad?
No.
You are from?
North Carolina.
North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And so you met here in the States, is
yes.
that correct?
Yes.
Right. How long have you been in the United States? When did you come here from India?
I came here first in 1953 when great President Eisenhower was the president. And I heard him speak and warning Americans about the military industrial complex. He said, if you don't watch out, they will be upon you. And I see that they are upon us.
Those are prescient words from Eisenhower.
Yeah, Eisenhower. I like him very much. I think he was a great president.
There is more coming out all the time about his much of his wisdom. We do have a caller here. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. Hello?
Oh, hi, I'm sorry.
Yes, you have a question?
Yes. When I was in college many years ago, I had several Muslim friends, and I read up about Islam. I was fascinated with it. And in the conversations now of, you know, trying to resolve these cultural conflicts, or imagine the cultural conflicts, I don't hear enough about Islam as a force for social justice, which was one thing that I really admired in it, and the egalitarian and equality that really is inherent in many aspects of that faith. And I would love to help provide an opportunity for really both of your guests to speak about that if they wish.
Is this Siddiqui?
Yes, yes. Okay. Islam, there is a book written by a very great scholar. His name is Shatabi. He says the higher objectives of the Islamic law. Unfortunately, people think of Islamic law, when they think of it only, it's a criminal justice system, but Islamic law includes all aspects of belief and worship, and it also includes a broad spectrum of social justice and social justice. So he, you know, this classical scholar, he describes the main objective of the Islamic law is to guarantee the protection of, in the following order, religion, life, progeny meaning our children and grandchildren, etc., the progeny, and intellect and property.
That's an order?
In that order.
Mm-hmm.
So that a person may sacrifice property to gain education, for example, you know, the priority. If there is a priority, this is the priority. And the wisdom of all Islamic laws is to promote civilization, to promote, to populate the world, and to bring a just society in the world. So the fundamental concept in Islam is all human beings are from one soul, which was shared by Adam and Eve. They are our parents, and all human beings are their descendants. And that way, we are one family. And there is, if you want to call race, there is one race, and that's human race. So this is the foundation. And the Sharia, that is the Islamic law, applies to all of them without distinction. There is no distinction whether you are a king or pauper or you're the from high nobility or low nobility. So whatever laws are, they are applicable to all human beings equally.
Mm-hmm.
This is the foundation of Islamic justice system. And then it incorporates economic justice, social justice. Economic justice is through the teaching that human beings are not really the owners. Only God is the owner of everything. And we are a trustee of whatever given to us.
Mm-hmm.
So we cannot say this property is mine. It is God's property, which is given to you for your benefit, for the family benefit. And what is beyond that is for the benefit of your neighbors, of your of your extended family, and of the poor in the family, and so on. So it defines how the wealth should be distributed so that there is a broad economic justice. There is nobody so poor that he will be, you know, destitute and not able to eat or mm-hmm. bring up his family. And there should be no such a rich person that he will be exploiting the resources for himself. So
mm-hmm.
that's the economic justice. It's called this based on the concept of cooperation rather than competition. And there is a principle of zakah. Zakah means a certain percentage of your wealth, not income, the wealth mm-hmm. that you have, you know, your assets, that has to be distributed under certain categories of people so that there is no poverty in your society. This is the ideal, of course. So this is the foundation of the justice in Islam, economic as well as social justice.
Just to follow up, what I thought the caller was pursuing, she apparently has had some previous experience or knowledge of Islam from the past. And is there a critical tradition that challenges the powers that be within Islam that would raise questions of social justice against existing governments or administrations?
Yes, there is a principle which is called enjoining what is right and prohibiting what is wrong. And there is a prophetic tradition. The Prophet Muhammad, he said that if you see anything which is wrong, and then if you can change it by hands, try to change it by hand. you cannot change it by your tongue, and if you even that, you cannot at least change it in your heart that if something is wrong, is wrong. And so there always have been in the Muslim countries, Muslim communities, people who have been critical of the any kind of injustice or tyranny from the government, something like that, always, or any particular person who is in authority. So there is this tradition, very strong tradition. And of course, you know, there have been dictators who try to suppress this. And then there will be, you know, a conflict or something like that. But there has been a tradition throughout the history of Muslims.
I think this comes as a surprise to many Americans. As I understand it, CARE, Council on American-Islamic Relations, recently did a study, and at least half of Muslims are perceived by Americans to be supporting terrorism. And there are lots of other stereotypes out there that are still real and alive. I gather that you spend a lot of time trying to combat these.
We do whatever is in front of us to do. I think that we should call to the attention of our listeners that Muslims are actually the ones who stand to lose the most from any acts of terrorism. We are basically hostages here because of the current situation. Muslims, I've been a Muslim for 40-some years, and Muslims, in my experience, are not mean, unprincipled, violent people, quite the contrary. But due to the conditions that confront us in this time, some people have chosen that path to rectify what they perceive as injustices. I just would like to call your attention to one extremely important fact, which might speak to the current situation in Iraq. There is a verse in the Quran which Muslims believe to be the direct word of God communicated to the Prophet Muhammad, which says, never should a Muslim kill another Muslim. If a Muslim kills another Muslim intentionally, his place is hell for eternity. So you can look at the conflict between Shias and Sunnis and imagine for yourself the fate of those people who are killing others. It doesn't matter what they call themselves. It doesn't matter what they say about themselves. They're under interdiction by God Almighty himself.
Let me say here, I'm a statistician. I teach against unwarranted generalizations. Mm-hmm. You say if one Japanese steals something, you say he's a criminal. If two Japanese steal, if another Japanese steals something, then they say, oh, all Japanese are thieves. That's false generalization. I teach that if you want to generalize, you have to have a very broad, random sample. And if all of them are doing something, or a majority of them, then there is a justification for generalization. Now, there are approximately 1.5 billion Muslims, and 19 crazy guys do something. So from 19 to generalize to 1.5 billion, I mean, this is ridiculous.
Just so that we make sure that our callers are aware, this is a call-in program, and feel free to call in to talk with our guest. The number is 333-9455, 333-9455 or WILL. You can also call 1-800-222-9455. Well, I understand that most of your time this past week has been at the center and at the mosque. Have you done much with during your time here with non-Muslims, have you had an opportunity to meet other people in the community?
I did not get a chance of that. The Muslims wanted to, as they say, squeeze the lemon.
Sure, sure.
They wanted to squeeze me and my wife for all the knowledge or benefit regarding their concerns.
Right.
See, I did not have
I can see why
opportunity
already.
To, although on my list there was a couple of programs where I was supposed to go to Mennonite Church or some other, I think a Mormon church or something like that. But I think that probably did not pan out.
But you have, you've done interfaith work,
yes,
I understand, before. What is your, why don't we just start with a very general question. How do you feel about interfaith activities in general since 9/11? Has there been a significant qualitative or quantitative difference after 9/11 as opposed to before?
Certainly there has. I remember a time when the Islamic Center in Fort Collins sent out letters to ministers of various churches saying that we could provide speakers on our faith, and we didn't get any responses. Since 9/11, there have been multiple requests in our town and probably throughout the country for speakers, because dreadful as the events of 9/11 were, they stimulated an interest in a faith that people had never heard of before. Who are these people? What do they stand for? So we in Fort Collins and this community here are in the midst of interfaith outreach, and I think that it's proven to be very fruitful because we are members of the Abrahamic faith community. We are believers in one God and the life hereafter and many, many other elements of faith that are common with Christianity and Judaism especially, and with other religions as well. And we would really like to make common cause as people of faith.
Before we turn to our next caller, just an observation. As I understand it, Muslims have been a part of this country since the beginning, since the revolution. Isn't that right?
That's right. And they were brought as slaves also from the West Africa, at least according to my research, at least 20% of the slaves which were brought from West Africa had Islamic faith, but then, of course, they lost it over the years.
So it's often characterized as the newest immigrant group. It actually, Islam and Muslims have been in this country from the very beginning.
That's it.
We have a caller. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. Your question?
Well, I'm Ernie, and among my many Islamic friends are Africans, East Europeans, Western Asians, and I found, as a whole, they're the most pleasant, accommodating, peaceful people that I have ever met. The one comment that I would wonder about is, where is the Islamic problem with people of the Baha'i variation or adaptation of Islamic faith?
Thank you for your question.
Baha'i faith, I think, it started in Iran. I'm not not that knowledgeable about it because this is just kind of vague. I am not very. But I think it was started something around 1870s or something like that. Mm-hmm. And we consider them as deviating from the true teachings of Islam, because Islam teaches that the Prophet Muhammad is the final and last messenger, and there is no prophet after that. So I'm not completely sure what their teaching is. If they consider Baha'u'llah or someone else as another prophet after Prophet Muhammad, then of course they're not a part of Islam. They're a new religion, you know, movement.
It's one of the youngest religions
youngest,
in the world.
Youngest, in that case. It's not then part of the traditional Islam.
Well, let's not speak for Baha'i here. Hopefully the caller will call back or someone from the Baha'i tradition and address that question. Let's talk a little bit more, if we could, before we leave the topic of general perceptions in the United States. In this community, we have struggled in a number of different ways, trying to reach out and understand and appreciate and respect The problem I have with the word tolerance is that you very frequently will tolerate that which you disdain or dislike. Do you have any suggestions for how we can get beyond tolerance to respect and genuine acceptance of each other's traditions?
We should call it more understanding and more reaching out to each other. I will go back to interfaith experience. What happened was after, on the day 9/11, I was here in California, my wife and I. Then we went back to Colorado and we heard that the Friday sermon, just following that 9/11, the first Friday, about 200 Christian and Jewish youth, they all came with flowers in their hands and they surrounded our mosque and then say, please accept, we will protect you. I mean, this, and right. This is, and this happened to...
And there was genuine fear.
Genuine fear. And so, I mean, we were so impressed with this, concern of compassion and so on, and we reciprocated that. So this is not tolerance. This is more than tolerance. It's more of respect the tradition of other people, and that the idea that all human beings must support each other, and the crimes of A, B, C should not be, inflicted right. on the people in this country, especially since we are also citizens of this country and we love this country. And, this is, let her say something.
Yes, ma'am.
I think that tolerance and that quality that we're looking for that's more than tolerance comes from knowing about each other. Islam denotes Christians and Jews as al-kitab, which means people of the scripture, because Islam rests on revelation from God, and we believe that God revealed himself through the earlier prophets, who include Adam, the first man. I'll just name the five greatest prophets in Islam. Noah, Abraham, Moses, Jesus, and Muhammad. It might surprise some of you to know that Jesus is considered as one of the greatest prophets in Islam, and that we believe he was born of a virgin mother who is considered one of the holiest, or perhaps the holiest, woman who ever lived. So I think that when we look at commonalities rather than differences, we find that we have an enormous amount in common, and we can build on that, and we can look at ways to cooperate and to try to put a little tiny bit of a candle in the darkness of a civilization that is very much turned toward materialism, to provide an element of spirituality and respect for traditional and religious mores.
I wonder if we couldn't talk just a little bit about this this general issue that many have raised as a result of reflecting on Islam throughout the world since 9/11. There are those who claim that the other Abrahamic religions underwent their reformation in Europe and that Islam hasn't. It's my understanding that is a misconstrual and misunderstanding of history. But I'm hearing more and more from people who claim to be in the know about Islam that it is sorely in need of reform and needs to be brought into the 21st century. I don't know if you watched this television series on PBS called American at a Crossroads.
Yes, we did.
Recently.
Yeah. Yeah.
That issue came up in at least two or three of the programs. How do you feel about non-Muslim critics and, to some extent, Muslim critics who say that Islam is in need of reform, as though Islam is one single thing?
There is a misconception among them that Islam is a product of human beings. But truly Islam is a revelation from God, which was given to Prophet Muhammad. And it is contained as pure as it was revealed to the Prophet. The Quran, which we read today, is exactly the same, word by word, which was revealed to the Prophet Muhammad. He dictated it to his companions. And so we cannot change the word of God, number one. It is what they say, reforming meaning, maybe some Muslims need to be reformed to go back to the pure teachings of Islam. How could you refine, for example, saying that God is one? We want to refine it to say that God is two or three. How can you, reform something like you? We are servants of God and we have to worship Him. Mm-hmm. How could you reform the idea that you should honor your parents and give charity to the needy? Mm-hmm. So the human relationship between human beings and God, mm-hmm. the relationship between human beings and other human beings, they cannot be reformed unless human beings have changed themselves. That is, are we growing out of the trees? We are still being born mm-hmm. from the parents, so there is no reform there. What they are saying is that they want to enjoy life. They want to drink, they want to do such and such or something, and Islam prohibits that.
Enjoy the secular benefits.
Enjoy the secular benefit of materialism. So, of course, you cannot reform Islam and to suit everybody else's. No religion will tolerate its teaching to be twisted to fit a person's, nafs, we call it nafs, It mm-hmm. is the desires or something like that. She can say
sure.
something more.
Yeah.
Islam is an Arabic word that means submission, surrender to God and to His commands and to His will as revealed through the prophets and especially through the Prophet Muhammad. There's no reformation possible in something that claims to be the revelation of God without completely distorting it. If you reform it, it will not be Islam anymore. Islam is not, according to my opinion, I don't have anything to say about it. It's given as it is, and no reformation is possible in what that is. So it's really an oxymoron to say Islamic reformation. These people are putting themselves out of Islam by the reforms they want to make, they will no longer be Muslims.
The European Christendom prior to the Reformation was pretty thoroughly dominated by political structure, power structure in the Vatican. And the Protestant Reformation was, to a large extent, a political resistance to domination, political and economic domination. Isn't it true that in Islam there really isn't, except once there had in the past, there was a caliph, and before that there were central authorities. But today Islam is not really like Christendom was before the Reformation in Europe. So it strikes me that calls for reform need to be better informed historically.
The thing is, when they think of Islam, they think as parallel to Christianity or the history. The history is entirely different. There was no persecution of scientists or science in Islam. In fact, scientific method
it preserved
was
it.
Invented by the Muslims, right. And they were honored, great honors. So there was no. There is no papal authority in Islam. There is no one sacred person apart from the Prophet himself, who interprets Islam. You can read the Quran, I can read the Quran and understand it, and there is a whole body of scholarship mm-hmm. behind it. the Prophet established a community of companions who have transmitted all this knowledge, accumulated knowledge. So there is no oppression of scholarship of any individual because of his beliefs. See, the Quran says there is no compulsion in religion. You know. So there is no such tradition as there has been in Christianity. So they just say that if there should be a reform in Islam, it's not needed.
Right. We have a caller. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. You have a question?
Yes, it's a very interesting program. Could your guest speak about the Wahhabi sect of Islam in Saudi Arabia and Egypt and elsewhere in the Middle East? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thank you for your question.
Okay, I could say something. This, you see, what happens in any religious tradition, that the initial pure teachings of religion, when they go to other countries, you know, Islam has spread as far as China, even in China, India,
Indonesia,
Indonesia and so on. So some customs, folklore kind of thing, they become part of part of that religion. So what happened was the veneration of the pious people. It took some kind of a slight twist there, so that the purity of worship of God alone was maybe mixed up with some, okay, the saints may be intermediary between between us and God, which is against the teaching of the Prophet. So this is a popular kind of folksy thing which got mixed up with the Islamic tradition. So Abdul Wahhab, who was born in Saudi Arabia, it was not Saudi Arabia then, just Arabia. So he said, well, let's purify.
What's his name again?
Abdul Wahhab. Abdul
Wahhab. Wahhab.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he said, let us purify the belief system of Islam. And so he started a movement against what he called Sufism, he thought it was saint worship. It was not saint. I mean, he went to a little extreme in that opposition to the folksy traditions, like Muslims celebrated the Prophet's birthday. He said, "Well, the Prophet's companions never celebrated it. Those followed him, so he wanted to eliminate all these things, you know." He led a movement. So he went kind of to the extreme.
Mm-hmm.
And that when the kingship came to his followers, they overthrew the previous king.
Saud.
And they established Wahhabi teachings as part of their political system. She may say something too.
Well, I'm not... I'm sorry on the subject, but commonly understood, Wahhabism is a very sort of rigid, narrow view of Islam that has eliminated many understandings and practices from the traditional Islam. They have just basically said, we don't accept this. We can go to the Quran and the Prophet's actions and words and figure this out for ourselves. We don't need these other people in between, so we will just do our own thing, kind of.
I think to segue with what we were talking about before with regard to reform, as I understand it, Wahhabism is radically conservative about the role of women, for example, educating women, and we've all heard about what has occurred with the Taliban in Afghanistan and the role that some Wahhabis played there. I take it that you have spent a good deal of your life and intellectual activity working with and for children, and I assume...
Five.
Sorry?
Five children.
Five children, okay. Can you speak to Islam's attitude towards, let's just take one specific topic, educating women and Do you care to speak to how you feel about that? A lot of Americans, I think, have a stereotypic view about that.
Mm-hmm. There is a prophetic saying, hadith, seek knowledge, even if it is in China. It is an obligation for every Muslim man and woman to seek knowledge, and even if you have to go as far as China to get it. Now, what kind of knowledge is not specified, but in order to raise sound children, I think that a woman has to have appropriate knowledge of so many branches of human endeavor and psychology and physiology and medicine and nutrition and. This is just for the role of mother and the rearer of the children. Certainly that kind of knowledge and education are obligatory. Then we go to questions about the education of women for career roles, perhaps. There is nothing that prohibits women from working. Many, many Muslim women throughout the world work and have obtained an education, but that shouldn't be a conflict with the role of mother and wife. So the first emphasis would be on what God has made obligatory on women, which is to take care of their children. This is first. And if you can do that and still manage a career or a job, then it's permissible.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller on line 4. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. Your question?
Yes. I'm sorry. It's the same person that called a little bit
ago. Sure, no problem.
I know from my reading, at least of translations of the Quran, that that it was actually commanded that parents instruct their daughters, you know, educate their daughters. I think it says educate them equally with their sons, but in any case, they are, you know, not supposed to be regarded as inferior intellectually in any way. I guess, you know, tangentially related to that, back to the question of reform, do the two of you see any possibility for adjustments to some of the very literal laws in the Quran, such as women getting one-half the inheritance of men? I know at the time, you know, in other parts of the world, women were getting no inheritance, so this was an advance, but I think there are circumstances where that represents too much of a hardship to women. And I'll take the answer off air. Thank you.
Thank you for your question.
If women are getting half the inheritance, it doesn't mean that they are unjustly treated. It's absolute mathematical equality is not desired. So justice is required. Yeah. So what happens is whatever a woman earns, it is hers. And a man is responsible to share his wealth with the family. Man is responsible for the families. So as I tell my wife, whatever you earn is yours, whatever I earn, yours too. You know, so this is and then when a woman gets married, she gets a dowry from a husband. The responsibility is on a man. So, and similarly, if a woman becomes a widow or somehow divorced or something, the responsibility for her maintenance is on her brothers or father, something like that. So according to that, the equitable, you know, whatever, if a man gets twice as much as the daughter, you know, the brother gets twice as much, but he is responsible for his family, so eventually he has to spend more, while what she gets is entirely hers. So there is an equity here, not equality, not everything, you know. For example, if I give you a large steak and I eat a smaller steak, it doesn't mean that I'm being half of you. That's what my appetite is. That's mm-hmm. what. So the Islam is looking for equity. You know, what is suitable for the needs mm-hmm. of every individual, rather than just absolute equality. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that woman is half of a man. It simply means that her needs are met in other ways. Mm-hmm. She has taken care of her needs.
Now, you have, as I understand it, translated some important intellectual works. What have you done in that along those lines?
I'm leading up to a question,
who are the
authors? There are some classical authors, some modern authors. Mm-hmm. One classical author is Dahabi, he was in 11th century. He wrote a book on the major sins. So I translated those. Mm-hmm. The 70 major sins in Islam, mm-hmm. including murder.
More than the seven deadly sins.
Seven deadly sins, yeah. There are seven deadly sins plus. So. Mm-hmm. And then I translated a book on what is permissible and what is prohibited in Islam, al-halal wal-haram in Islam. So, mm-hmm. as a modern author, al-Qaradawi, I translated some hadith, that is the prophetic's translation, his sermons, his advices, and so on. Recently, this was mm-hmm. done recently, and one an Islamic concept and its characteristics, a book by Sayyid Qutb, which is a modern author. You know, mm-hmm. So these are some of the works which I translated. And in the beginning, you see, when I came here, there was hardly any literature. There were many converts to Islam who wanted some. So I wrote mm-hmm. Islamic correspondence course with the help mm-hmm. of my wife. She's being an American. She corrects all my English. I coming from overseas, my language is Urdu. In Urdu, we don't have articles, definite article or indefinite article. Mm-hmm. So I keep forgetting definite articles. She puts the definite article. She puts commas, mm-hmm. semicolons, periods, and so on. So we together, actually, whatever I write, she improves upon it and makes it. So these are some of the
Do you go back to India?
I never went back to India. I left India, I went to Pakistan. And from Pakistan, I could not go back to India. I came here, I married, I got settled here, and then, mm-hmm. although, you know, there are a lot of family there, not mm-hmm. immediate family, but my cousins. When I say family, we count seven cousins, you know, seventh cousin as family also. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I did not go back to India. I've been to Pakistan.
And you've raised five children?
Yes.
And they're all grown?
They're all grown. And there are 14 grandchildren coming from them. And
my goodness.
Four great-grandchildren.
So where are your children now?
They are quite scattered. One is in Michigan, one is in California, one is in Oregon, one is with us in Fort Collins, and one is overseas.
Boys, girls?
Mm-hmm. Three girls and two boys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, could we talk a little bit about the children's literature that you have written? You, I understand, have the pseudonym Suzanne Hanif.
Yes.
What is out now that's available? I understand that we can find something of yours at Borders.
I don't know about Borders.
That's the information I was giving. I'm sorry.
Okay. Amazon has some of my books.
Okay.
The first general book I wrote is called What Everyone Should Know About Islam and Muslims. Then much later...
When did that come out? Sorry.
In the 70s. Then sort of a redo of that because I had... started out with a rather verbose style that I wasn't happy with. I didn't feel it served the purpose. So I simplified my style and wrote Islam, the Path of God, much more recently. And the last book that I've published and probably my final book is called A History of the Prophets of Islam. It's a two-volume work, about 1,000 pages, and the first volume goes from Adam through... up to Moses. The next volume starts with Moses through Jesus and brings in a lot of material about Muhammad. I wrote because there was and still is to an extent a dearth of Islamic literature written by Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided, well, let me do it.
Mm-hmm. One last request for calls. We're getting close to the end. If you care to call in to ask a question of our very distinguished guest this afternoon, the number is 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. I wonder if we couldn't talk a little bit more about the literature that is out there for someone who is a beginner and is good-willed and is genuinely wishing to understand and to confront this issue of stereotypes over and above what seems to me to be some very good work that you have written. What would you recommend that's available to people out there to read that's available?
I would suggest if anybody wants a good translation of the Quran, there are 8 or 10 or more than that. I would suggest a translation called Sahih International. It's spelled S-A-H-E-E-H, International. It's, I think you can certainly find it online.
You type that in and you would find it?
Probably so. If not, there are Islamic booksellers that have it. I like it because it's in more contemporary English. It doesn't, I think it's truer to meanings. It has rather limited footnoting, but nonetheless, I think that's satisfactory and sufficient. I would advise people not to read a Quran without commentary, that is, without footnotes, because that's really critical to understanding the historical and other contexts of the Quran.
And some footnotes are better than others, right?
Right.
From one translation to the next.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. We really have a dearth of good Quranic commentaries in English. I am not very pleased with any of them except Sahih. If you want to know about the Prophet of Islam, I would suggest a book by an author, a contemporary author who died recently, Martin Lings, L-I-N-G-S, and it's called simply Muhammad. And that you could probably get almost anywhere online.
Are you acquainted with Karen Armstrong?
Yes.
What do you think of her book on Islam?
I actually haven't read it.
Mm-hmm. It's the most widely.
Yeah.
It's a most widely sold book right now.
Yeah. There are some reports that she has embraced Islam, but I don't know. I read her autobiography many years ago, and I wrote her a letter and I said, like, you have left Catholicism, but you're a believer. So, dear lady, the place you need to look is Islam. And here she is being an exponent of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
We're happy with her commentaries and her role as a moderator. And she certainly has very good knowledge, but I don't know how her books come across. I do think that if you can find a good Muslim, a practicing Muslim writer who's seeing it from within and explaining it from within, it's perhaps much more useful than reading a book by somebody who is an outsider looking in and has never really sort of experienced what it's like to be inside.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if we could talk a little bit about an issue that it was raised by this series, America at a Crossroads and elsewhere, that program had some problems, but it also was very provocative, and that is this issue of leadership within the Muslim community in the United States. Apparently there is a movement to try to develop leaders for local mosques throughout the United States of a particularly or uniquely American bent. Do you have any opinions about that effort?
Let me give the experience in our own community in Fort Collins.
All right.
Until this year, we had usually the president was elected some Libyan or Saudi Arabian or Pakistani, people of that bent, but this year, the whole community elected an American Muslim. Mm-hmm. And not only the president, but also vice president, an American Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
And it is very refreshing right now, you know, experiencing that they are more dynamic. They are,
Why is that?
Well, because they are American know-how. Okay. No, American know-how. Mm-hmm. People who come from Middle East usually don't have that kind of aggressiveness or, you know, involvement with American society. So this vice president, he has started a program like yours. Every week he has 1 hour for presenting Islam and callers calling in and so on. And then also involvement in city commissions or something like that, reaching out. So we are experiencing a slightly different way of management here. Mm-hmm. It may be going on in other places also. Mm-hmm. In fact, the largest Islamic society, which is called Islamic Society of North America, it has elected a woman president, an American Muslima. She is a professor of Islamic studies at Hartford Seminary. She has been Muslim for a long time, 20 plus years. And so she has taken the realm of this largest Islamic society. Mm-hmm. So it is a natural process, I suppose. First the immigrants were dominant. Mm-hmm. Now they have a lot of Americans. At least 30% of Muslims are probably native-born Americans. Mm-hmm. So they have involved themselves in their managerial skills and their speaking skills and their involvement with community and their representation of Islam to the facing the government and to the people. Mm-hmm. They have just more, it seems like they are more efficient in these. So whatever is needed, we are not prejudiced against anybody. I mean, that's what it means, neither against women taking realm or Americans or new Muslims or old Muslims. Whoever is dedicated and sincere to the cause of Islam, they are taking role.
Well, as I understand it, until recently, there really hasn't been there haven't been schools for developing leaders in the United States, such as there are most notably in Egypt and Saudi Arabia and elsewhere. But as I understand it, that's changing, isn't that right?
That's right. There is one very good institute called Zaytuna Institute in Hayward, California.
Where? Hayward?
Hayward. Hayward, yeah, established by American Muslims, Hamza Yusuf and some
that's
other.
The fellow that that was featured.
That is invited by, that's right, yeah. Mm-hmm. He was invited by the president after 9/11 also.
Right.
He was an advisor to the president. Mm-hmm. So he has traditional Islamic learning. Mm-hmm. This institute is traditional Islamic learning. Mm-hmm. So that is established, and there is some open university, Islamic university also. So there are efforts being done.
It's called Open Islamic University?
Islamic University. It is by correspondence, I think, mostly correspondence.
So it's online?
It is through correspondence.
Yeah. Oh, I see.
Through correspondence. You can take a degree and learn all the classical things.
Well, listen, thank you for being with us. We have had some very interesting conversation with Dr. M and Mrs. Ziba Zidiki, who have been here for the 14th to the 21st at the Central Illinois Mosque. Thank you very much. This is Don Nolan, Keeping the Faith.
You're most welcome.
I'm so sorry.
It's an invasion that shows no signs of slowing down, and it's more pervasive here in America than you might realize. It's Japanese popular culture, from the cute Hello Kitty backpack purses to the Pokemon pocket monsters. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we'll explore Japanese popular culture. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, mostly cloudy and breezy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. The low in the upper 50s with south winds 20 to 25 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy and breezy with a high in the lower 70s and west winds 20 to 25 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low in the lower 50s and north winds 10 to 15 miles per hour.
WILL programming is funded in part by a grant from TK Service Center, 806 Perkins Road in Urbana, offering automotive repair on cars and trucks by ASE-certified technicians. In business since 1984, they perform computerized engine diagnostics.